Okay, we're beginning here on the top of Samach Tet Amud Aleph. Talalei Rav, Larabi Bene Chite. Rav placed something, according to Rashi, he put this question between the rows. He squeezed in a question between the rows. He was sending him a letter, just of friendship, just ask him how he's doing. And in between the rows, he squeezed in this little question. According to the Rabbeinu Chananel, who Tosafot quotes, he sent them a list of many questions. And these were letters that were stitched together. Each one was a section that was stitched together. And then he squeezed in between the stitches, he squeezed in this extra question. This question then ends up by Rabbi. And Rabbi opens up the letter and is discussing the question. Why this question was so important or focused on, but likely is because of the context of our Gemara. Not necessarily because the way that Rav presented or placed the question, he was either trying, he added the question afterwards, he remembered it, or he was trying to squeeze it in with his letter asking Rabbi how he was doing. Remember that Rav is a Talmud of Rabbi. So it says, Tali Rabbi ben Echite, Achin Sheshibdu Mahu. The brothers that encumbered their property, what is the din? Aviyoti Rabbi Chia Kamei. Rabbi Chia was sitting there with Rabbi. Remember, Rabbi Chia is also Rav's uncle and a Talmud of Rabbi. Amalei Micharu Omeshkenu. Was it a case where they sold it and that's why it was encumbered now? Or is it a case where they gave it away as a mashkon? Amalei, so Rabbi responds to Rabbi Chia, my nafkamino. What's the difference? How they encumbered it? Ben Machro, Ben Shemashkeno, Motziin Leparnasa. Whether they sold the property or whether they gave the property over as collateral, Motziin Leparnasa. We allow the women, the girls of the estate, to take that out for their dowry, which is the Isur Nichasim, the 10% of the estate which they are entitled to. This goes back to Rabbi's statement yesterday about the fact that Parnasa is Tarfe Mishabde, that you're allowed to take the Parnasa, the dowry, out of encumbered property. That was talking about encumbered property of the brothers, not of the father, but the brothers. Once they've inherited the property, the estate, if they transact with the estate, people who buy from the estate know that any girl that is a part of the estate is entitled to 10% of the estate for her dowry. Vein Motziin LeMizonot. That is not true by Mizonot. And again, the difference being that one is Katsuv, one is a fixed amount, so purchasers or people dealing with the estate know that this exists and know how to deal with it. They can leave over, they can make sure that they leave over sufficient funds in the estate, or they know how much they will lose if the girls come after them for the dowry. On the other hand, by Mizonot, which is an unlimited factor, there we don't allow them to take from Mishabde because of the Takanata Shuk, which is then the transactions will be undone, people will not be able to interact with the estate, because they'll be afraid that someone's going to come after them from unlimited funds afterwards. Virav, imachru kimimbaile, if it's a case where they sold it, nichtavle mechru, that they sold it, imishkenu kamibaile, if it's a case where they gave it over as collateral, nichtavle mishkenu, let him write that there's a case of collateral. Why did Rav not ask the question in particular to the case that he was querying about? Rav, tarvayu kamibaile. Rav really wanted to know the answer to both of these questions. If I wrote down that they sold it, hanecha, then I'll know the answer to that question. If I say there that when they sold it, you're allowed to take the property back for the dowry, then certainly in the case of collateral, you can take it back because sold is out of your possession totally. A mashkon is still somewhat in your possession. So of course, if you can take or reverse a sale, you can certainly reverse the collateral. If he says to me, no, by sales, you cannot reverse the transaction for the dowry, then akate mishkenu kamibayli. Then in a case where they used it as collateral, I wouldn't know the answer to that question. If he wrote the case where they made it as collateral, if they sent to me that you do not take out for that, then certainly in the case where they sold it, then also they would not reverse the transaction. Ishalakle Motziin. On the other hand, if he says, yes, you're allowed to take back a mashkon, I still have a question with regards to if they sold it, whether I would get it back. Echtov le shibdu. I'll send him a question that just says encumbered. The mashma hochi, umashma hochi, which has both meanings to it. And therefore, in the answer I will get, I'll know that it references to both. And if there is a significant difference between them, then he'll make that distinction, or he'll make that qualification in his answer, and I would know that there's a difference between mashkon and mechira. Rabbi Yochanan amar, echad ze ve'echad ze ein motzi'in. So here Rabbi Yochanan is disagreeing with what we just saw from Rabbi. Rabbi says as far as the dowry is concerned, you're allowed to take out of the encumbered property, but not the mizonot. On the other hand, Rabbi Yochanan says it doesn't matter whether it's the dowry or the mizonot, ein motzi'in. One is not allowed to take it out of the encumbered property. Again, the encumbered property of the banim, of the children of the estate who have now transacted in the properties of the estate. Ibailu the Rabbi Yochanan. According to Rabbi Yochanan, lo shmiele had Rabbi. He never heard the position of Rabbi. Vishmiele have a makabale. Had he heard it, he would have accepted Rabbi's position. The only reason he took his stance is because he didn't know that there was a Tano, Rabbi, who took this position. Odilma shmiele velo makabale. Maybe he did know about Rabbi's position. He just did not accept what Rabbi said. Tashma, ditmar. We have an instance. Mishemate. Veniach shtebanot uben. A person passed away. He leaves over an estate, and he also leaves over two daughters and a son. So the son is the inheritor of the estate. The two daughters have their rights within the estate, both of them to collect their dowry, get the 10%, the isur nechasim, as well as their mizonot out of the estate. Ubekadma harishona. Then the first of the daughters went ahead. Venatla isur nechasim. She took her 10%, she took her dowry out. The second daughter didn't take out her dowry before Ad Shemeta Ben. The son passed away. And when the son passed away, the estate now goes to the two daughters. The two daughters become the inheritors of the estate at this point. So the first daughter's already taken her 10% out of the estate for the dowry. The second daughter either hadn't reached the point where she was getting married, or she just had gotten engaged and she went to claim her dowry. And she has yet to get her dowry. Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Shnia Vitra. The second one gives up her rights here in the estate. And that's it. We don't make any claim for her. So the first daughter will actually end up with 10%. And then the remainder of the estate, the 90% remaining of the estate, she'll get half of that, which is 45%. So she'll get 55% of the estate. And the second daughter, who never took her dowry, only gets 45% of the estate. Amar Rabbi Chanina, Gdolo Mizu Amru. Greater than this, we've said, motzim le parnasa, vein motzim le mizonot. We've said before that even if they sold the property out of the estate, the girl has the right to take her dowry back from that. Not for mizonot, but at least for the dowry. Va'at amart, shnia vitra. And you're telling me that the second one gives up? Why would she give up if she has such powerful rights? She has such powerful rights that in the case of sold, in a case where it's left the estate entirely, she can go back and pull that money back and get her 10%. Here where the monies are still sitting in the estate, certainly she should be entitled to her 10%. Vimita, it was the case, Nimalei Manamra. If he wasn't sure about who Rabbi Chanina was quoting, he should have said, tell me the attribution of this statement. This statement is going against what Rabbi Yochanan said, or is undermining what Rabbi Yochanan says. Rabbi Yochanan should have asked about the attribution, the statement, to know who had said it. The fact that he doesn't means that he knew about Rabbi's statement, and seemingly did not bother him that he was poskening against Rabbi's statement. Mar says, V'dilma lo'olam lo shmiele. Now, maybe he never heard of Rabbi's statement. V'chi shmiele kabil. And when he heard Rabbi's statement, he accepted it. V'shani haltam. And over here, he had a differentiated opinion, not because he disagreed with Rabbi, but he thought these circumstances were different. Dika rabach beta. Because over here, she is gaining so much. Over here, she's getting half the estate, something that she never envisioned. So since she's getting half the estate, she doesn't worry about that small 10%, which in the end really turns out to be 5% loss for her because she's splitting the estate with her sister. Had she gotten the 10% up front, she would have gotten a little more, but without it, she gets a little less. In that instance, maybe she would give up the 10% because she's getting much more than she ever imagined. But in a case where she didn't get it much more than she imagined, like in a case where they sold the property out of the estate, there she would have the right to get back her dowry, to get her 10% back. Tosafot over here asks the question, what happens if you have 10 daughters in the estate? In a case where you have 10 daughters in the estate, the Ran quotes it as being 10 daughters besides the first daughter. In a case where you're certain that you're not going to get more than 10% by the division of the estate. So in that case, there's no Ravach Beita. In that case, there's no benefit to her from the inheritance. Her inheritance actually will be less than the 10%, the Is Nechassim, that she's entitled to as her dowry. So maybe over there she would want to exert her rights and claim her 10% before she gets the Yerusha, because 10% is worth more than what she'll get as a Yoresh of the estate. For Tosfos leaves it as an unanswered question. And of course, there are Rishonim come down on both sides over here. One is that you're right. In those instances where there is no Ravach Beita, we would grant her the 10%. Others say that that's an unusual case. Any case where the estate is getting divided up, we will not grant her the right of Iser Nechassim, because now we're in a different, we're working under a different mandate, which is the mandate of Yerusha, not the mandate of the here exists an estate and they have rights to the estate. So they lose their right to the Iser Nechassim over here, despite the fact that they might lose out a little bit in this instance, because it's no longer a question of do they get a portion of the estate. It's a question of how do we divide the estate, and then they no longer have the rights to exert that 10% of the possessions. Now the Gemara continues. Amalei Rav Yemar the Ravashi. Eliyam Amiato. If you're right, Ashkecha Mitzia Ba'alma Dika Ravach Beita Hachanami Deloya Binan La Iser Nechassim. So if she finds a mitziah, and now she's gained much more than she thought, then she'd also suspend her right to get the Iser Nechassim, to get the 10% out of the estate. Amarlei, Ana Ravach Beita Mihani Nechse Kamina. I'm talking about her benefiting from these items themselves, the estate itself. Over there, the mitziah is an exogenous variable that you're bringing in. Yes, she found something, and she made a lot of money when she found this mitziah, but that doesn't replace her right to the 10% in the estate. When she inherits the estate, then the 10% and her inheritance of 50% of the estate are coming out of the same pool of money. So in that case, we'll say, because she's getting much more than she thought, we don't worry about the 10%. Over here, where even though she made a lot more money than she thought, it has nothing to do with the estate. Her eye on the estate still is for that 10%. Correct, but that's, he mentioned the word Ravach Beita, that she has sufficient, or her household is well subsidized. You can have, basically what he's creating is the same effect of inheriting the estate she has through an independent item, like a mitziah. And the answer is exactly what you're saying, which is, that's the problem, it's independent. And her view on the estate is that I either get my 10%, if I get much more than 10%, then I won't worry about the 10%. But if I don't get my 10%, I want my 10%, even though I've made money somewhere else. Amar Meimar, Bat Yoreshet Havyo. So Meimar says over here that this daughter, vis-a-vis the monies that she receives, the dowry that she receives, she has a din of a Yoreshet. Amar Lei Rav Ashi, the Meimar, Ilu Bayi Lisluka Bezuzei, Hachanami Delo Matzi Lisluka. If that's the case, then the brothers, who are real inheritors of the estate, they want to pay her out her 10%. So what do? They want to pay her money to get her out of the way. They say, we'll pay you your 10% and just leave us alone. Can they do that? Well, it depends. If she's considered to be a purchaser here, then they can give her the money. If she's considered to be a Yoreshet, a inheritor of the estate, inheritors of the estate are entitled to their portion of the estate across the board. That means that she's entitled to 10% of everything in the estate. And that'll be no matter what is in the estate. So you can go through the whole estate. I'll take 10% of that piece of land, 10% of that piece of land, 10% of that piece of land. And they can't force her out by just paying her out on the money. And we're like, yeah, you're right. That is the case. Similarly, if they want to give her one parcel of land to pay her out her 10%, they can't do it. Again, she has rights to 10% of every piece of land. And we're like, yeah. Again, he affirmed that's the case. If she's considered to be a Yoreshet, that's exactly her din. Her din is she's entitled to 10%. She cannot be forced to take money instead or in lieu of her inheritance. Now, if she agrees to it, that's fine. But if she doesn't agree to it, then she can take 10% across the board. Rav Ashi Amar Bat Balat Chov Avya. Rav Ashi, after hearing this from a Meimar, seemingly disagrees with a Meimar and says that a Bat is not a Yoresh, an inheritor of the estate, but rather a creditor to the estate, and she collects as a creditor. Vafa Meimar Hadarbe. And later on, a Meimar reversed his position, which is likely why Rav Ashi's position differentiated from a Meimar, is because even though he heard it from a Meimar, Rav Ashi had a differentiated opinion, because in the end, the Meimar reversed his position and agreed with what Rav Ashi said. The Amar Rab Minyumi, Berei Derab Nechumi, Havakamina Kamei Dameimar. I was sitting before a Meimar in a case. There was an adjudication going on. And this woman came before him, and she wanted her 10% of the estate for her dowry. And I saw, I could read his mind, that if they wanted to pay her off the 10% in monies, that he would have allowed it. Because I heard from the brothers, had we had the cash, Salikna bizuze. We would have pushed her out with the cash. Ve'ishtik v'lo amalu v'lo mide. And a Meimar never objected to their plan. Now you could argue that a Meimar didn't object to their plan because it wasn't a feasible plan. They didn't have the money to push her out. So he wasn't addressing it because they couldn't do that. But they're speaking within the context of the court. You're right, they didn't present it as a formal idea to the court. So you could have thought that maybe that has no meaning. In the end, we see from this that Rav Nyume is medayik from the fact that a Meimar did not address it, that there's meaning to that. From that, you see in the Tosafot, Mikan Ragil Rabbeinu Tam. For this reason, Rabbeinu Tam had the practice, Sheyoshev Bedin, when he was the judge adjudicating a case, Ve'echad mi'balei dinim, Migzam l'chaveiro, Ve'omer kach v'chach t'chayv li bedin. And one of the two parties exaggerates to the other party and says, if I win, this is what's going to happen to you. They exaggerate the outcome of the situation. Then, Ragil haya Rabbeinu Tam lamar, shekata egver. You are lying. Rabbeinu Tam would address it right away. How does he know to address it? From our case over here. Seemingly in our case, the brothers had no plausible way to actually execute on their plan, number one. Number two is they didn't present it to the court. They were just speaking within the context of the court that, well, if we could do this, we would have done that. Yet we see Rabbi Nyume, by the fact that a Meimar didn't address it, is willing to be medayek out of that, that that has real value. So the Rabbeinu Tam, based on that, would shut down anything said in the court that wasn't true. Because otherwise people would then assume that if he didn't say something, that actually would be true, whatever they're saying. So he would say, if you're in the context of the court, then being silent is an acquiescence to whatever stance the parties are taking. So he used to speak up anytime this happened in a court case. When we say now that she's a creditor to the estate from the father, or she's a creditor to the estate in terms of the brothers. This will make a difference, we'll see in a second. The Mainaf Gemina, what's the difference? The Migva, the Beinonit, Shelo Bishvua, that is to make a claim of Beinonit, the level of property that she can make her claim against without a Shvua. Viziborit bishvua, or ziborui, which is the lowest form of property, by a shvua. A creditor, in general, is entitled to benonit property, to middle-range property. The Gemara discusses this in other places as to why we would give the creditor benonit property, because we don't want to empower him too much to the point where debtors would lose out. We don't want to give him such poor quality property that he's not going to be willing to lend. So we went with the middle of the road, benonit, for the Baal Chob. So if she's a creditor against the brothers, then she really is like a live creditor now, because the estate exists and she's a creditor on the estate. She will collect from Beinonit. Now she also will not have to take a Shvua, because she's a current creditor to the estate against the brothers themselves. They are the debtors. She is the creditor. Everyone is present. There's no need for a Shvua. On the other hand, if we say she's a creditor of the father, she'd be no different than any other creditor. A creditor that comes to make a claim against the estate of the father, number one is, when you're nifram mina yitomim, you only get ziborit. You get the lowest grade property. That's number one. Number two is, when you're nifram mina yitomim, you have to take a shvua. In order to collect from the yitomim, you have to take a shvua, because the yitomim in a real sense don't have, or can't be a counter to the party that's making the claim. They were not the debtors. Their father was the debtor, and they can't say anything against this creditor. So how do we vet the creditor in this case? We force him to take a shvua in order to ensure that, first of all, he never got paid back on his loan. And number two is that there are no other issues outstanding here that the creditor is subverting so that we don't know about it. So we make him take a shvua in order to clarify the situation. The same is true here, is that we make her take a shvua. Now that's despite the fact that over here it's slightly different than a normal case. In a normal case like by an almanah, when you talk about a widow who's coming to claim from the estate, we worry about the fact that her husband gave her cash or money, sarare, And everybody make her take a shvua to ensure that she's not double collecting against the estate. Over here, that's a very unlikely scenario that the father gave money to the daughter and is a tsrare to be for a dowry. That even though that's an unlikely scenario, nevertheless, we put her in the same bucket as all the other creditors of the estate and say that she's got to take a shvua here in order to collect. Again, even though here there's very little likelihood that she previously collected or there's any reason to believe that she's cheating the estate over here, nevertheless, she, like any other balat chov, would have to take a shvua. So that's the nafkamina to whether she's a creditor of the father or the brother. So my, what is the din? Tashma. Deravina agve the brate deravashi, mimar brei deravashi, benonit, vishalo bishvua. Mi brei deravsama brei deravashi, ziborit, bishvua. So here's your answer to the question, which is that in the case where the daughter of Rav Ashi appears in court asking for her dowry. So now Rav Ashi has sons. He has Mar Brei de Rav Ashi, Mr. the son of Rav Ashi, who is more well known because of his appearances in the Gemara, as well as Rav Sama Brei de Rav Ashi, who is also another son. The only thing is that Rav Sama predeceased his father. So Rav Sama predeceased his father. In this case, his son, Rav Sama's son, is the inheritor of that portion of the estate. Now the estate falls to the two brothers, Rav Sama and Mar Brei de Rav Ashi. Rav Sama's not alive, so that drops down to his inheritors, to his son, to the grandson of Rav Ashi. So 50% of the estate is going to Mar Brei de Rav Ashi, and 50% of the estate is going to Rav Sama's son, the grandson of Rav Ashi. So now he wants to take out his 10% to give to the daughter of Rav Ashi. So 5% of that's going to come out of Mar Brei de Rav Ashi's portion of the estate. 5% of that's going to come after Rav Sama's son, the grandson of Rav Ashi. So in the case, when he collected out of Mar Brei de Rav Ashi, he collected out of Benonit without Shvua, because she was a direct creditor against the brother. Mar Brei de Rav Ashi is her brother. Since she's a direct creditor there, she collects out of Benonit and doesn't need to take a Shvua. On the other hand, when she came to collect from the son of Rav Sama, over there, she was a creditor against his father, Rav Sama Brei de Rav Ashi. But now Rav Sama passed away earlier, and his son is now a yatom that collects the father's estate. So she was a creditor against his father that has now been dropped down. The estate is dropped down to the grandson. So then ziborit, she only gets ziborit like when you collect from any yatom. And bishwa, she has to take a shwa in order to take monies out of the estate of a yatom. So you do have the answer here. The answer here is that she is a creditor to the brothers in terms of the estate. And because of that, the outcome here is that when she goes to claim against the brother, she takes benonit without a shvua. She goes to claim against a grandson. In that case, she will have to take ziborit with a shvua. Shalach le Rav Nechemia, brother of Yosef, the rabba bar Rav Huna Zuta. So Rav Nechemia, the son of Rav Yosef, sends this to rabba bar Rav Huna Zuta, minardo, from Narada. Ki atyaha itatalekamech, when this woman appears before you, Agva iser nechasim afilo mitstrobla. You can collect the 10% of nechasim even from the itstrobla. Rashi over here says it's the moshav amatare chaim. So there are two different interpretations over here as to what this is, whether it's the base of the mill. The mill has two stones, the base stone and then the grinding stone. So this is the base stone. Or others say it's the hopper in which the finished flour flows into. After you've ground the grains, the flour that comes out falls into this hopper. That's what this istrobla is. What he's suggesting over here is that the istrobla itself is like karka. And since you would take dowry from anything that is karka, therefore we entitle you to also take it out of the istrobla because it's deemed to be like karka. It has character traits like real property, and therefore you can collect out of it, even though it seemingly is metaltalim. Nevertheless, here we'll let you collect out of it as if it is karka. Amar Rav Ashi, kevin and bei Rav Kahana, have a magvin afilu mi alma debete. They used to take it out of the charge of the house. So this is like amlo today, where you have charges or fees that are charged. So over there, they're talking about the rent. That rental, house rental income, that rental income you can collect the dowry out of because it's deemed to be karka and not metaltale. Now, everybody asks about that. Wait a minute. How is that karka, not metaltale? When someone pays chirut, when someone pays for their rental income, they pay cash. When they pay cash, cash is deemed to be metaltale and not karka. So why would you consider that to be karka, not metaltale? So the way that Tosafot explains it over here, and other Rishonim have slight variations of this, but basically along the same lines, which is, they rented it out for 12 months. 6 months of the rental have now elapsed. We know that, ain't Schirut Mishnalemet Ela Basof. Schirut is only paid for at the end. So when they finish the 12 months, they're going to pay the entire Schirut. They're going to pay for the rental. But now they've already accrued 6 months of rental income, which is owed. Even if they walked out of the deal right now, they'd have to pay for that 6 months of income. So they've accrued 6 months of income. And it's the equivalent of what we call perot ha-mechuberot ha-karka, perot that are attached to the ground. Because the rent is associated with the house itself and has yet to be made into metaltalim through being paid. So therefore, it's considered to be like real property and accrued rent that they have now earned but yet to collect. That will be deemed to be karka, and since it's deemed to be karka, she can collect out of those monies. All right, so now we have another case, which is Shalach Le Ravanan Rav Huna. So Rav Hanan sends a message to Rav Huna. Huna Chavrin, our good friend Huna, Shalem, hope things are good, how are you doing? Ki atya hai itet elekamech, when this woman appears before you, agva isu nechasei, you should collect the 10% for her dowry. We've vetted the situation. And please go ahead and make the collection. The property is by you, or the estate is by you. And we've looked into this, and she's deserving of her dowry. Abiyoti Rav Sheshit Kameh. Rav Sheshit was sitting in front of Rav Huna. Amalei Zil Emalei. I want you to go back to Rav Hanan and tell him this. Ubishamti Hei Man Delo Amalei. And if you don't say exactly what I want you to say, you're going to be bid into Shamta. Obviously, Rav Huna is a little upset about what Rav Hanan sent to him, and he wants Rav Sheshit to go back and say exactly the words that he's saying because he wants him to know that he's upset. And he says, Anan, Anan. That was his response to him. You, Anan, Anan, Mikarke, O, Mimitautale. Do you collect these Yisun Yechasim out of just real property or can you collect it out of Mitautalim as well? Uman, Yotiv, Be Marzicha, Beresha. And in the Beit Avel, who sits first? Now, he just used the word Beit Marzicha, which he did not explain what Beit Marzicha is, but he says, in the Beit Marzicha, who sits first? Who sits at the head? Also, Rav Sheshit, the Kameh de Rav Hanan. Sheshit went before Rav Hanan. Now, Rav Sheshit was not so comfortable saying this, because Rav Sheshit is a Talmid of Rav Huna, and clearly a Talmid or younger than Rav Hanan. And for him to come and speak in such a chutzpahdik manner to Rav Hanan, he didn't feel comfortable with. So he prefaces his statement and says, Amalei, Mar, Rabba, Rav Huna Rabbe de Rabba, says, my master, you, my great Rebbe, and Rav Huna, the master, or the Rebbe of the master here, Vishamuti Shamit Mandalo Amarle. And he put into Shamt anybody who didn't say over what he wanted. Vilav de Shamit, Lava Kamina, and if he didn't put into Shamt, there's no way I would be saying what I'm saying. So he prefaces it to say that I'm not doing this of my own volition, I'm doing this because I was compelled by Rav Huna to come and say this to you. And then he repeats exactly what Rav Huna asked him to do. Anan, anan, min karkei, o metautale, umayin yoti beir mazicha beresha. Also Rav Hanan, the Kameh de Marukva. So Rav Hanan appeared before Marukva. Amalei, chazi mar hechi shalach li Rav Huna. You see how Rav Huna sent this message to me. He was obviously offended by what he sent. Anan, anan. First of all, he says anan, anan, which is not a natural kavod, talking to me like a lay person. And then, ba'od, marzicha, the shalach le yadana, manehu. And he sends me this thing about Beit Marzicha, I have no idea what he's talking about. So Amalei, emali easy. He says to me, listen, young man, my Talmud over here, why don't you tell me the whole story? The way that you get stories from your children, you only get one half of the story. Or he says to me, why don't you tell me the remainder of the story, why Rav Huna is actually sending you this? This didn't come out of the blue. Why don't you give me the rest of the story? What really happened in this circumstance? Amalei, hachi v'achi avimase. He says, here, this is the incident. Amalei, gavra, delo mayoda mayniu marzicha, shalach le Rav Huna, Huna chavrin. He says, I'll explain it to you. If you don't know what a Beit Marzicha is, then how is it that you're sending to Rav Huna, Huna chavrin? Our peer, Huna, our friend Huna. Now, what's clearly going on here and why Rav Huna was offended is because Rav Hanan is a Talmid of Rav Huna, or clearly not of the stature of Rav Huna. And the fact that Rav Hanan sends to him, dear Huna, our good friend Huna, and did not address him as a Rav, and preface it with a salutation that included a kavod to Rav Huna, Rav Huna is offended. And Marukva is explaining now to Rav Hanan, the fact that you don't know this information is clear that you're not a peer of Rav Huna. And the fact that you addressed him as a peer, that's what the problem is. Now the Gemara just goes in and figures out, my marzicha. What is this marzicha that we're talking about anyway? Avel. It means a mourner. So that's his question was, who sits at the front? Who sits at the lead in the house of the mourner? Dichtiv. Ko amar Hashem, al tavo beit marzeach. And Yirmiyahu says, don't come into the house of the marzeach. And then it continues, the remainder of the pasuk is, al yispod, you should not give a eulogy. So it's clearly in the context of talking about avelut. So there, beit marzeach is talking about the house of the deceased, the house of those that are mourning for the deceased. So that's what marzeach is. Now the Gemara will take on and discuss this in more detail, but that's what he was sending to him. What that question has to do with the remainder of the statement is not clear. He either sent it because he realized that he wouldn't know it. It was something difficult. That's one possibility. The other possibility is that you can prove from a pasuk in Yirmiyahu what the answer is. And he was pointing out to him that you don't even know your mikra. You don't even know your psukim, and you're calling me Huna Chavrin. So that was the slight that he was sending back to him. Or the other possibility is, we're going to see in the latter part of this Gemara here that the Avel is considered to be a marzach, someone who thinks of himself as being of stature, even though he is not of stature. And he was pointing that out to Rav Hanan as well, that you're elevating your status, even though you don't really have that status, and calling me Huna Chavrin. Those are some explanations to why he used this as the vehicle for clarifying the fact that he had spoken improperly. I'm Rabbi Baumin. I love Vel Shem Yisev Berosh. How do we know? We saw this in Moed Katan as well. How do we know that the Avel sits at the head? Shenamar, Evchar Darkam Veshev Rosh Veshkon Kamelech Bagdud. I will choose their way. I will sit at the head. I will dwell like the king at the head of his forces, at the head of his legions. Kasher Avelim Yinachem. The same way that mourners are comforted. So the Gemara says exactly what I explained it, which is Yinachem Acharim Mashma. And Yinachem does not sound like the Avel, the mourner himself, is sitting at the top. Rather, that the comforters are the ones that are sitting at the head, comforting the mourner who is down low. So the actual comforters, those that are coming to console, are sitting at the head. That's the way the pasuk sounds. So Amar Rav Nachum Bar Yitzchak. So here, the tiv and the kri play in here. The kri is what we say, which is yinachem, which is that they're coming to comfort the mourner. But the tiv is yinachem, or there are those that say yunucham, that the mourner should be comforted. So therefore, it's referencing not to the ones that are coming to console, but rather those that are the avilim themselves that sit at the head. So that's what it says. It's yinucham or yinachem k'tiv, because there's no spelling of the word. Rashi goes through a lot of detail as to why you would read it this way without the kri, without the mesorah, as how to read it. Why would you read it in this manner? Because he says you would need additional letters to read it as yinachem, and therefore you have the possibility of reading it as yinachem or yinucham, and that would reference to the mourners themselves rather than to the consolers of the mourners. Tell us what doesn't buy the whole thing. He says it's all dachuk, and he says just the word itself, yinachem, is ambiguous. And since it's ambiguous, it can mean both. And since it can mean both, then we can suggest over here that it means that the mourner sits at the head, just as likely as we can say that the consolers sit at the head. And so because of that, the ketiv allows us that opportunity that if you really wanted to make a statement, you would have used minachem or minachamim. The fact that it doesn't use that term and uses this term, the ambiguous term, indicates to us that it's referencing to the mourners. When they come to console, where do the mourners sit? Where's the placement of the mourners when we come to console them? Do they like hold court? Who's given the respect in that case? So for instance, a prime minister or somebody big walks in. Is the prime minister sit in the middle and the mourners sit around the prime minister, or is the other way around? But the mourners at the head and the prime minister sits around the mourners. That's the question here. So Marzutra Amar Meocha. We learn it out from this in Amos. It says, Vesar Mirzach Sruchim, that you will go Barosh HaGolah, you will go at the head of all the captives, and your feasts and festivities will be made or made laid to waste. Mar Vizach Naseh Sar L'Sruchim. The person who is embittered, Vizach, and Rashi says here, Mishnaf Shomara V'dato Zacha, and his mind is Mutukami Alav, his mind is removed from him, it's taken away from him in a sense. He's unable to think clearly. So that person, as a sar, he becomes the leader, l'sruchim, to all those that are there or present. Sruchim, some quote from Serach Ha'odef, the piece that's left over, the extras over there. So that can be looked at as both as any party that's coming, or Serach means the great ones. the great ones who are the additions or the extra pieces over there, no matter who it is, he will sit in the front. Others suggest over here that the Mar Vizach, the person who is bitter, is Vizach. He's made into someone who is Zach Dato, that he's greater than others. He sits above others in that case. And that's where the play on the word is, that the Zachut Adat, that he's given this ability to act as if he is someone special. And that's what it means over here, that Sar Mirzach Sruchim, the Beit HaMazeach, the Avel, is empowered to be the head. Even though he's not the head, we make him feel like he's the head. And that might be part of the consolation that we do for the mourner. That despite the fact that he's had a loss now, and he's despondent, and he's low down, and his mind isn't clear, nevertheless, we elevate him and make him the head. So the people come to him, and that might be part of the nechama, similar to, like the Marsha says, similar to the wine that we give to the mourner in order to clear his mind, in order to him to forget that which is bothering him or causing him the despondency. Same thing over here. The fact that he's low down and he has a loss, if we elevate him and put him in the front, that might be part of the consolation that takes place, part of the nechama that we do for the Avel. All right. Amar Rava. Now we have a conclusion of our sugya, according to Rava. Hilchata. Mimikarkei v'lo mitaltalei. You collect the isur nechasim, the parnasa, the dowry out of real property, not from mitaltalim. Ben the mizonei, ben the ktubah, ben the parnasa. That's whether it is for mizonei, which we've seen before. Mizonot are unlimited items, so therefore you can't take them out of, first of all, encumbered or property. Number two is you only take it out of real property, not out of mitaltalim. And that is ben the ktubah. It's also for the ktubah itself, for the woman, the almanah, who's coming to collect her ktubah. And the last is the parnasa, that the parnasa also is only collected out of karkei and not mitaltalei. Now what's interesting here, Tosafot references you back to Nun Aleph, where he spoke about this. There, Tosafot claims that the takanat ge'onim applies to the dowry as well, applies to parnasa as well. Because we saw in yesterday's daf, the end of yesterday's daf, that parnasa is not one of the tnayei ktubah. It's not one of the conditions or the enactments of Beit Din to be part of the ketubah. Parnasa sits separately from that. It has a totally different din. The takana of the gonim related to ketubah itself. And it says that the ketubah itself can be collected not only out of karka, like the Gemara concludes, but also out of metaltalim. Again, to address the change, societal change, that people now were extremely wealthy and owned no land. And how could you believe that creditors were lending money to this individual thinking they were going to collect out of his land? He doesn't own any land. He owns maybe the house that he lives in, but he has tons and tons of money. And therefore, mitaltalim became something that were a security to lenders. And that means that people relied on people's wealth, not simply on their real property. So that dynamic changed the gonim, changed that for the ketubah as well, and said, by the ketubah, the woman is not just relying on this guy's karka. She's also relying on his mitaltalim. Therefore, by the case of Mizonot, and the case of Ketubah, one is the Ketubah itself, one is a derivative of the Ketubah, it's clear that the enactment of the Geonim applies to that by Metaltling. What is not clear is by Parnasa, by Dowry, which is not an enactment of the Ketubah, which is a separate din, as we saw at the end of yesterday's daf, and Rabbi says it's not one of the Tnei Ketubah, does the enactment of the Geonim deal with that or not? Tosafot back on Nunalef makes it clear that he thinks so. He thinks that because of what's called amidne. We saw that in yesterday's daf. The difference between when we assess the father's generosity. Is he a miser or is he a very generous individual? If we knew what the father would give in these instances, then we would give what we would assess the father to give. If we don't know, then we give 10%. 10% was the default when we didn't know what the umdana of the father was. But if we knew what the umdana of the father was, we would give them based on what we knew the father would grant in that case. Tosfot says, metaltalim are no different than that. Metaltalim are no different than an umdana. We know that a father would grant his daughter the dowry out of both real property and metaltalim. So we know today that we assess individuals, this is without knowing any information about the person, whether he's a miser or generous, we know that he would give the amount out of metaltalim. He would pay. Today, nobody would blink an eye about giving their daughter metaltalim and not karka. Maybe in the time of the Gemara, they would only give karka, not metaltalim. So he says, Tosfot says, in an ingenious way, how does this enter into the Takanat Gonim? Because this is the Umdana. The Umdana is that people use Metaltalim like they use Karka. Since that's the case, we can assess every individual in that way and say, if whether he was generous or miserly, he would pay out of Karka or Metaltalim equally. And therefore, Metaltalim now are deemed to be like Karka because of that Umdana. So Tosfos brings it into the Takanat Gonim in that way. Obviously, there are other Rishonim who disagree and say that Parnasah is not one of the subsets of Ketubah, and because of that, it remains like any other Baal Chov, and it remains that it only can be collected out of real property and not out of Metaltulim. Right? Tosfot also mentioned earlier that when we calculate the 10% for the Isur Nechasim, that 10% is collected out of the total estate value. We don't just say 10% of the real property. We don't look at 10% of the karka, and then she's entitled to 10% of the karka. Even though we're paying her out of karka, the 10% is an assessment of the entire value of the estate. So you'll take an entire value of the estate, say she's entitled to 10% of it, then you will take that 10% out of the karka. So the payment has to be made out of karka, but the assessment is not made out of just the karka. It's not just 10% of the karka, but it's 10% of the entire value of the estate. All right, next Mishnah. Hamashlish ma'ot levito. Person who passes money to his daughter, and he does it through a third party. He basically uses an escrow to get the money to his daughter by placing it in the charge of another individual. So he gives money to this individual. V'hi omeret neman bali alai. My husband is trustworthy to me. Yaseh ashlish mashuhushlash biyado. The party that was empowered, the escrow over here, should do what he was supposed to do. Divrei Rabbi Meir. So this person was charged with buying property with this money for the benefit of the daughter. So now the daughter says, just give the money to my husband, and he'll buy the property. I trust him to buy the property. Rabbi Meir says, we don't do that. We don't listen to the daughter's claim over here. And we say, do what the niftar, do what the person who charged you with taking care of this situation, do exactly what they said. Buy the property. And want it in property form, not in cash form. Do what the mate said. Make sure that when you grant it to the daughter, it's property and not cash. Rabbi Yossi Omer, V'chein Eila Sadeh. In the end, what is he going to do? He's going to purchase the property. V'hi Rotzah L'Mochra. Harihi Mechura. Me'achshav. If she wants to sell that property, after she receives the property, she has full rights to sell the property. So why does it make a difference if you hand her the cash and then she buys the property and says, my husband will buy the property for me? Or you hand her the property and she can go liquidate the property for cash. In the end, you're not going to end up with what you want anyway. When is that true? Someone of age, someone is underage, that's not true. The action of a ktana has no bearing. All right, so now the machloket here between Rabbi Meir and Rabbi Yossi, the Gemara will indicate, is whether there's a mitzvah lishma ledivrei amet. Is there a mitzvah to do the command of whatever the mate told you? The person who was passing away, he left you instructions. Do you have to follow those instructions? So Rabbi Meir says we follow the instructions, mitzvah leso divrei amet, and therefore we have to follow him. Rabbi Yossi disagrees and says that in the end, if you're going to unwind whatever he said, then why bother to go through the whole trouble of buying the property when she can do the same thing and liquidate it? Just do what the semblance or the idea of what the mate wanted, which was that he wanted the money to get to his daughter. So that's what you do. You don't have to do exactly what he said. That's one way to look at Rabbi Yossi. The other possibility here is that Rabbi Yossi agrees that it's mitzvah leshmo ledivrei amet. That's only when the divrei amet are going to stand. Meaning that if the divrei amet, when you do them, are going to remain intact, then there's a mitzvah leshmo ledivrei amet. In a case when you do the divrei amet and they can be unwound, then what's the point of doing what the maid said if it's not going to hold water anyway? And maybe Rabbi Yossi agrees with the underlying principle, just disagrees about the fact that in this case it's not meaningful. All right, Tanu Rabbanan. Hamashlish ma'ot lechatano. Likach mehen sadeh lebito. Person who grants money to his son-in-law to purchase a field for his daughter. V'hi omeret, itnatnu lebali. Just give the money to my husband. Menenasuin harishut v'yada. If she's already married, she can do what she likes. Minarusin. If she's only halakhically engaged, yaseh ashlish mashuhushlish v'yado, divrei Rabbi Meir. Then the charged party here, who's supposed to take care of this escrow, should do exactly what the charge was. Rabbi Yossi Omer, Hagdola, if she's of age, ben min nisuim, ben min erusim, or should be ada, then she has a right to determine where the money goes, because again, based on what Rabbi Yossi said in the Mishnah, she can transact in the property. Since she can transact in the property, why does it matter if she says, give the money to my husband, don't give it to my husband? Tana, ben min nisuim, ben min erusim, in a case where she is of underage, then whether it's nisuin or erusin at that point, yaseh shlish mashuhushlash biyado, then the shlish should do whatever he's supposed to do because the ktana has no ability to sell the property. Since she can't sell the property, she can't make the claim that we're indifferent between giving her the money or the field because she can do what she pleases with the field. That's not true here. She can't do what she pleases with the field because she's a Tana. My Benayu, where is the Nikudata Machloka between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Meir? If you want to suggest that a minor who is married is the difference between them, there are Meir Sabar Rishut Biyada. In that case, Rabbi Meir says, look, she's married, she can do what she likes. Va'ata Rabbi Yossi the Meimar, and then Rabbi Yossi comes along and says, Afilu min Nisuim, nami gdola in ktana lo. That when it comes to Nisuim, only if she's of age do we consider her to be independent, and therefore we grant her the monies to make her own decision with it. Va'ata ktana, no. Ema Seifa, what are you going to do with the latter half of our Mishnah? The last line of our Mishnah says, Ava ktana, in masek ktana klum. That when it comes to a ktana, the action of a ktana has no bearing, has no weight whatsoever. Haman ktani lo. Who's the author of that position? If you think it's Rabbi Yossi, you already know that from the first statement of Rabbi Yossi. The reason that Rabbi Yossi says you grant the money to the husband to buy the property with is because she has the ability to sell the property. Well, that ability is only true in a gdola who has the right to transact, then that's true. A ktana who does not have the ability to transact, although that would not be true. So Rabbi Yossi already told us that a ktana cannot be the case over here because a ktana doesn't fit into his definition of why you're giving the monies to the husband because she has a right to transact. A ktana does not have a right to transact. El Rabbi Meir he. The latter part of the Mishnah is a statement within Rabbi Meir's position. V'chasurei mechsera. And it's missing some words. V'chim ktani. This is what it says. Yaseh shlish mashuhushlash biyado. That the shlish must do what he was charged with doing. This independent party, this escrow account where the father gave the money and told him, go buy property for my daughter, he must do that. That's only true by Erusin, where the girl does not have the right to transact. But in Nisuin, where she becomes an independent party, over there, we would say, go ahead, she can transact, and the shlish does not have to then act based on that. But we're going to qualify that as well. Big dola v'abktana in masek tana klum. That's only true by a gdola, but by a ktana in masek tana klum. Ella gdola min erusim ika benayu. This is the nafkamina between their positions. It's a girl who's of age from the erusin. Rabbi Meir clearly makes the distinction between nisuin and erusin. Says only in nisuin does the shlish no longer have to do what he's directed, but rather give it to the husband, and it's fine if the daughter says so. That's only a case of Nisuin, and Nisuin where she's a Gdola. Right? Nisuin of Gdola, everybody agrees that she has the right to tell the escrow account or the party that's holding the third party here to give the money to her husband. In the case of a Ktana across the board, everybody agrees that there is no right to change what the Shlish was charged with because the Ktana doesn't have the ability to transact. So everybody agrees, whether it's Ktana min Erusim, Ktana min Nisuin, the money has to be used to buy property, and we don't listen to her whatsoever. What's the difference between them is Arusa Gedola. By the case of Arusa Gedola, for Rabbi Yossi, she's a Gedola. And since she can transact, we grant her the right to say, give it to my husband, and he'll buy property with it. On the other hand, Rabbi Meir says that's only true by Minisuin. When it comes totally independent and connected to her husband, then she can say that. By an Arusa, she doesn't have that right yet. So the nafkamina between Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Meir's position will only be by an Arusa Gedola. Itmar. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel, Halacha ki Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi Yehuda Amar Shmuel says what we would expect here. Machloket Rabbi Yossi and Rabbi Meir, Halacha is generally like Rabbi Yossi. On the other hand, Rova Amar Rav Nachman, Halacha ki Divrei Rabbi Meir. Over here, the Halacha is like Divrei Rabbi Meir, and as Rashi says, Taima Mishum de Mitzvah Lekayim Divrei Ameit. Because we have a principle that we want you to listen to whatever the mate says and do what the mate says. Since over here, the Shlish, by buying the property, is doing what the mate says, even though it could be unwound afterwards. Nevertheless, we tell him, do what the mate said. There's a mitzvah, the Shema L'divrei HaMeit. And therefore, since Rav Nachman is a Dayan, and therefore he gets extra powers when it comes to Pesach Halacha with regards to things that are Din Choshen Mishpat, the Halacha is actually like Rabbi Meir in this instance. Okay, Ilo Talo Nafshe Biskaria de Makuta. Ilfa hung himself up from the mast of the ship. Here the Gemara is pulling you in the middle of a story. It's a story that takes place in Tanit, where Ilfa and Rabbi Yochanan were learning together. They were chavrutot, very close. And then they reached depths of poverty, and they could no longer continue to learn because they could not afford to learn. So at that point, they both decide they're going to go into business in order to make some money because they can't survive by continuing to learn. Rabbi Yochanan hears a little voice behind them saying that this is a good time, that you should stick it out and you should keep learning. He turns to Ilfa and asks him if he heard it, and Ilfa says he didn't hear anything. So Rabbi Yochanan continues in learning. Ilfa goes out to do business. When Ilfa comes back from doing business, he's very successful, makes a lot of money. They had already appointed Rabbi Yochanan as the Rosh Yeshiva. He became the head, and he was enriched because he was made the head, and they gave him money, and now he was able to survive and pay his way because he was no longer poverty-stricken. So they say to Ilfa when he returns, had you been here, had you not been away, we would have appointed you because you were greater than Rabbi Yochanan. So Ilfa, in order to show that he didn't lose anything from his transacting, going out to do business, puts himself up on the mast of the ship and says, anybody ask me a question that I can't answer, and he'll explain the question right here, I'm going to fall off the mast here. And basically his point was that I'm still as good as I was when I went before, and I should still be deserving of a position like Rabbi Yochanan. So he says, Amar Ema Ika Da'ati Damar Li Milta Debe Rabbi Chiya Rabbi Oshia. Somebody quotes me a Brito from Rabbi Chiya Rabbi Oshia, who are the Brito that we consider to be vetted Britot, Britot that have real weight and are considered to be proper Britot. And I do not show him a hint to this in a Mishnah. How could Rabbi Chiya and Rabbi Oshia, who are Talmidim of Rabbi, and have Britot, whatever they put in the Britot has to have a source from Rabbi. And since Rabbi is the Misadera Mishnah, there has to be a source in the Mishnah for whatever they're saying, or hint to it in the Mishnah. So he says to me, you bring me any Brita, I'll show you the source in the Mishnah. So Nefila Miskaria Vitavana. If I don't give you an answer, I'll fall off the mast of the ship, and I will drown. Ato Usabo. So someone took up the challenge, some elderly man came to him and says, Tanalei, Homer, person who says, Tnu Shekel Livni Bishabat. Give my son 1 shekel per week, as is Mizanot. Vereen Litain Lahem Sela. On the other hand, they are deserving of getting a selah, meaning that their lifestyle, what they're accustomed to, or their needs, require a selah. A selah is 2 times of a shekel. A shekel is half a selah. So he gives them half of what their needs are. Nodim lehem selah. Then we give them a selah. Because when he says give them a shekel, he means gave them at least a shekel. And therefore, when we give them a selah, we're not undermining what the mate said. The mate said give a shekel. We'll give him a shekel. We'll give him a shekel plus a shekel. We're not changing it. But v'yimamar al tenu lehem ela shekel. If he says to them, don't give them anything more than a shekel, ain't no name, I'm el a shekel. Then you can't reinterpret his words to say, oh, a shekel plus. Here he says, don't give them more than a shekel, you have to give them a shekel. Vim amar, imetu yirshu acherim taktehem. If he creates that his estate is a remainder trust, which means that we are going to pay them this stipend every week, and after they pass away, if there's a remainder to this estate, that remainder will go to another party. They will not be the inheritors of the estate. In that case, Benchamar Tznu, Benchamar Altin Tznu, Ein Olim Neil a Shekel. In that case, whether he formulated it in the positive or the negative, we only give them a shekel. Because there's another party that's a beneficiary over here. So we can't just say, oh, when he said give them a shekel, he meant at least a shekel. Because if we give them more, then you're hurting the remainder trust. You're taking away from what's going to be left over afterwards. Now, how the remainder trust works is not so simple over here, because in general, a person cannot disinherit his children from his estate. And over here, he's basically giving them money, and then that money is saying in the end, they don't inherit it. So, in the end, it evolved that the estate just goes to them because they're the Yorshim of the estate, and he can't disinherit them. So the Rishonim come up with different ways to explain how that works in this instance. Some suggest that this is a matana. It's a gift. So since it's a gift, he can make the rules of the gift. Since he makes the rules of the gift, he can control it because he gifted it before he died. And gifting it before he died, he set up all the rules of that gift. It's not working like Yerusha, it's working like a gift. Others suggest it is working like Yerusha, but because he controlled the Yerusha and didn't make it into a full Yerusha, doesn't take on the properties of a full Yerusha. Full Yerusha, you're right. If they got it, you can't create a remainder trust when it's working like Yerusha. But over here, where he qualified it and said they're only getting a stipend, then he didn't make it into full-fledged Yerusha. Since he didn't make it into full-fledged Yerusha, it's not governed by that rule that anything that remains goes to the Yerushim, and he can make it into a remainder trust. But along those lines, the Rishonim had come up with ways to solve the problem of why he's allowed to gift in these instances and disinherit his children by granting the monies as a remainder trust to others. And you also can argue that it was set up front. Since he said it as a remainder trust up front, it doesn't follow the default process of following as Yerusha. You'll say, Amalei, Hamani, so Rav Ilfa answers, where's the source for this in the Mishnah? Rabbi Meiri, it's our Mishnah. Damar mitzvah lekayim divrei amet. That braita is premised on this idea that we want to listen to what the mate says. Therefore, we listen to what the mate says, and in a sense, we disinherit the children. We only give them the shekel, even though they need twice as much money to survive. We only give them what they are entitled to based on the divrei mate. In a case where we can reinterpret the words of the mate, we will do that to their benefit. But on the other hand, if we can't reinterpret it to their benefit, we won't do it in that case because it hurts other parties, and we want to keep all the divrei mate. So he says that's the source from the Mishnah for this position. And as Tosfot says, afilu bebori kaimalon hochi. We hold like this, not only by a mate, but even by someone who's healthy, makes a statement like this, and then dies, we want to keep what he says. Even though he wasn't a shchim meira, sitting on his deathbed when he made the statement, but once he makes the statement and then he dies, we want to keep what he said. And therefore, mitzvah lishma, the divrei mate, the kayim divrei mate, applies to whether it was said while he was healthy or even when he was said when he was dying. The Rabbeinu Tam asks a basic question over here. He says, then if it's mitzvah lekayim divrei mate, then why do we need divrei shivmeira kiktuvim misurim dami? Why do we ever need this principle that a shivmeira, someone on his deathbed, when he gives a last will and testament, it's as if it's written and we carry it out. Why do we need that? We just said here, mitzvah lekayim divrei mate. So then why do you need this extra power by shivmeira? So he brings down two nafkamina, v'omer rabbeinu dolo amrina mitzvah lekayim divrei mate, elok shehushlash mitchila lekach. This is one of the ways to get around that problem we said before of Yerusha, is that if you give it to a third party, it's escrowed. So in that case, that might be the way that you're getting around the problem of Yerusha over here, is because he escrowed it. And he says that the mitzvah l'kayim divrei mate is only in a case where he escrowed the money. If he didn't escrow the money, then there's no mitzvah l'kayim divrei mate, and then shchim meira would kick in. Or, in a case, inami davka b'mate notein b'chayim mikabel. It's only a case when the mate is granting it while the recipient is alive. Are granted as if the party was alive. So even if the party passes away, then their yorshim will get it because the gift is granted. So there's a difference between divrei amate, which will only apply to someone who is there to collect on the divrei amate, versus divrei shchimira will apply to even the person who's not alive anymore. Their yorshim will be entitled to the rights that were granted to them. So he made snafkamino between divrei shchimira versus mitzvah lekayim divrei hamate. I'm Rav Chisdar Marmakufa. Hilchata, ben shamar tznu, ben shamar al tznu, nodin lahem kol tzorcham. In the end, halacha is whether he said give them, whether he said don't give them more than, we give them everything they need. Wait a minute, hakayim alon halacha ki Rabbi Meir, damar mitzvah lekayim divrei amate. Don't we paskin like Rabbi Meir that the halacha is that we mitzvah lekayim divrei amate? So in the case where he made a positive statement, please give them a shekel, there we can give them more because we're not undermining what the mate said. But in the case he says, don't give them more than a shekel, how are you giving them more than a shekel? Hane mile bin mile achranita. That's by other cases. Aval baha minach naichale. Over here, he really wants his children to get their full stipend, what their needs are. Vadamar hochi. So then why did he say only give them a shekel? Li zaruzinu hudaato. He's trying to give them a message of values. He's trying to impart to them a value, not to be mi'unagim, not to spend excessively on their food and on their pleasures. So he says to them, look, you should try to work with the shekel. If the shekel is not sufficient, I'll give you more money. But I want you to think in terms, value-wise, of working with the shekel. If you need more, you'll get more. But think of yourself and know that this is the value that I'm imparting to you, that the estate will grant you a shekel. Yes, you'll get more. But I want you to think in terms of a shekel. And it's like today where people have trusts that are set up, where the beneficiaries of the trust have to conform to certain conditions in order to get the trust. That's what he's saying over here. I want these children to be imparted with certain values. I don't want them to just get the money. I want them to understand that they have to value the money that they're receiving. So I say a shekel, which is less than their needs, in order to give them that value statement. In the end, if they need more, I want them to get what they need. And therefore, it's mitzvah lekayim divrei amate. You are mekayim divrei amate because you're imparting the values to them. It's not autumn. We have a mission over there. Apu utot mechan mekach. Umemkaran mecha bimitautalin. Pu'utot are young children, 6 or 7 years old. If they transact, their transactions are transactions. It means that if they purchase or sell in mitautalin, then those transactions are good transactions. Amarafravam loshanu elincham apitropus. That's only if there's no executor to the estate. Avayesham apitropus, if there is an executor to the estate, then ein mechan mecha, fein memkaran mecha. We reverse it because executor is the one who's taking care of this, and we don't let them go and undermine the executor of the estate. The executor of the estate is appointed either by the father or the Beit Din to exercise the rights over the estate. And we're not going to allow these young children to transact and to undermine basically the Divrei Amet over here. Mimai. How do you know that this is the case? Midiktani, because our Mishnah says, in Masek Tanakum. We see from a Mishnah that the actions of a minor have no bearing. The Dilma Hechadika Shlish. Maybe that's only true when there's an escrow, a third party that's taking care of this. Shiny. Maybe that's different. Gemara says, Im Kein Litnei Avobuktana Yaseh Shlish Mashu Shlash V'yado. Then they should have qualified that statement at the end of the Mishnah and say, by Aktana, then the appointed party, the escrow account, should do what he was in power to do. So my Ein Masek Tana Klum. Why does it make a definitive statement that the actions of Aktana have no bearing? Shma Mina Afilu Ba'alma. That even in general, they have no bearing. Now, Tosfot over here qualifies this already. It says, Perish Rabbeinu Chananel, Dafka Mecher. It's only true when you're talking about transactions. Ava Matanatan Matana. That when it comes to gifts, they can give things and it will be gifts. Delinya Matana in Svarada Chalek, Ben Yesham Apichobus Leinsham. They want to give gifts or grant gifts to individuals. It should make no difference whether there's an executor toward the estate or not. In the cases where there's an executor to the estate, in those instances, we say, listen, they bait an appointed executor in order to monetize the estate and get them their needs. We're not going to let the minors come here and transact and undermine the instruction they were given to the executor. So we reverse that. In the case of Matana, the executor is not giving out gifts. He's not the one who's granting gifts. So therefore, if the children want to grant gifts, that does not undermine the power of the executor, does not clash with the power of the executor, and therefore the Rabbeinu Chananel says they can't grant gifts. You could argue otherwise, which is that the executor here is to protect the children. And as a guardian and protector of the children, he doesn't let them give gifts willy-nilly. You'll have to vet the gifts as well, and therefore you'll have control over gifts as well, and you could argue on the Rabbeinu Chananel in that case. The last thing to discuss here is that the Gemara in the end of Baba Batra notes that individuals are not allowed to transact in properties of their father until they're the age of 20. Over here in our Mishnah, and based on the Gemara here, it seems that the threshold is Gedola versus Ektana. As soon as the person becomes of age, we allow them to transact in the properties. Nobody seems to disagree with that point as to whether they're allowed to transact in the property or not once they become a Gedola. How come over here that's the case? How come over here they're allowed to transact even though they're under the age of 20? So the Ran on the Rif here brings down different dayot. He brings the day of the Rashba, the Raivod, and brings his own day out here as well. One distinction that is drawn over here, it's the difference between a matana versus a yerusha. In the case of yerusha, the individual is not empowered to transact in their father's property until they are the age of 20. When it's given as a gift, then the gift itself is not governed by those rules. The gift is a gift to do with it as you please. And therefore, once they reach of age, once they become a gdola, they can already transact in the property. So that's one way to solve the problem of the differentiation between the case over here and the case over there is because one is a case of Yerusha, one's a case of Matana. The other instance here is the instance or the case over here is a case where they gave ma'ot, they gave money, and the money is supposed to be used to buy property. So in the end, what you have here is not necessarily karka in the sense of karka. It's karka because he wants to take the monies, the ma'ot that were there, and then transfer that in or that value into karka. So since that's the case in this instance, we're not going to say that they're governed by the normal rules of karka. Because what's left with the shlish was not karka. What was left with the shlish was ma'ot. And that ma'ot then is supposed to be transferred into karka. So what he's trying to grant his daughter is money, not necessarily karka. So in that case, we grant them the rights to transact inside of the karka, even before the age of 20. Because that doesn't undermine what he wanted. He wanted them to get the value. That value can be there even if they transact in the karka. The last, the Ran himself suggests over here the possibility that the gzeirah, the takanat chachamim about transacting about 20, is only in what we call shchiach, the normal case. A normal case is where a son inherits the father. The son inherits the property of the father. In that case, we limited his rights to transact until he reaches the age of 20. Anything that's not shchiach, that's not your common case, is not governed by those rules. Over here, you have a daughter inheriting or gaining property from the father, even if you call it Yerusha, not a Matana. Nevertheless, since it's a daughter who doesn't normally get Yerusha, she's not governed by the normal rules of Yerusha, which is that you can't transact until you're 20. So the Rishonim here are trying to come up with ways to distinguish this or differentiated from that case in Bava Batra, and they use all of the different situations or circumstances here to show that this is different, and that's why the daughter here is allowed to transact as soon as she becomes a gedola, versus in the case there where you can only transact when you reach the age of 20. Okay, with that we finish the Perek Hadranalach Mitziat Aisha.